their bones and skulls on their lace tufa. Their language was lost. Here and there, one still finds the remnants of a menagerie, a brain plate covered with figures. What has all this to do with you, Moldorf? The word in your mouth is anarchy. Say it, Moldorf. I am waiting for it. Nobody knows when we shake hands the rivers that pour through our sweat. Whilst you are framing your words, your lips half parted, the saliva gurgling in your cheeks, I have jumped halfway across Asia. Were I to take your cane, mediocre as it is, and poke a little hole in your side, I could collect enough material to fill the British Museum. We stand on 5 minutes and devour centuries. You are the sieve through which my anarchy strains, resolves itself into words. Behind the word is chaos. Each word a stripe, a bar, but there are not and never will be enough bars to make the mesh. In my absence, the window curtains have been hung. They have the appearance of Tyrolean tablecloths, dipped in Lysol. The room sparkles. I sit on the bed in a daze, thinking about man before his birth. Suddenly bells begin to toll, a weird, unearthly music, as if I had been translated to the steppes of Central Asia. Some ring out with a long, lingering roll, some erupt drunkenly, maudlinly. And now it is quiet again, except for a last note that barely grazes the silence of the night, just a faint, high gong snuffed out like a flame. I have made a silent compact with myself not to change a line of what I write. I am not interested in perfecting my thoughts nor my actions. Beside the perfection of Turgenev, I put the perfection of Dostoevsky. Is there anything more perfect than the eternal husband? Here, then, in one and the same medium, we have two kinds of perfection. But in Van Gogh's letters, there is a perfection beyond either of these. It is the triumph of the individual over art. There is only one thing which interests me vitally now, and that is the recording of all that which is omitted in books. Nobody, so far as I can see, is making use of those elements in the air which give direction and motivation to our lives. Only the killers seem to be extracting from life some satisfactory measure of what they are putting into it. The age demands violence, but we are getting only abortive explosions. Revolutions are nipped in the bud, or else succeed too quickly. Passion is quickly exhausted. Men fall back on ideas, comme d'habitude. Nothing is proposed that can last more than 24 hours. We are living a million lives in the space of a generation. In the study of entomology, or of deep sea life, or cellular activity, we derive more. The telephone interrupts this thought, which I should never have been able to complete. Someone is coming to rent the apartment. It looks as though it were finished, my life at the Villa Borghese. Well, I'll take up these pages and move on. Things will happen elsewhere. Things are always happening. It seems wherever I go, there is drama. People are like lice. They get under your skin and bury themselves there. You scratch and scratch until the blood comes, but you can't get permanently deloused. Everywhere I go, people are making a mess of their lives. Everyone has his private tragedy. It's in the blood now. Misfortune, ennui, grief, suicide. The atmosphere is saturated with disaster, frustration, futility. Scratch and scratch until there's no skin left. However, the effect upon me is exhilarating. Instead of being discouraged or depressed, I enjoy it. I am crying for more and more disasters, for bigger calamities, for grander failures. I want the whole world to be out of whack. I want everyone to scratch himself to death. So fast and furiously am I compelled to live now that there is scarcely time to record even these fragmentary notes. After the telephone call, a gentleman and his wife arrived. I went upstairs to lie down during the transaction. Lay there wondering what my next move would be. Surely not to go back to the fairy's bed and toss about all night, flicking breadcrumbs with my toes. That puking little bastard. If there's anything worse than being a fairy, it's being a miser. A timid, quaking little bugger who lived in constant fear of going broke someday, the 18th of March, perhaps, or the 25th of May, precisely. Coffee without milk or sugar, bread without butter, meat without gravy, or no meat at all, without this and without that. That dirty little miser. Open the bureau drawer one day and find money hidden away in a sock. Over 2,000 francs, and checks that he hadn't even cashed. Even that I wouldn't have minded so much if there weren't always coffee grounds in my beret and garbage on the floor, to say nothing of the cold cream jars and the greasy towels and the sink always stopped up. I tell you, the little bastard, he smelled bad, except when he doused himself with a cologne. His ears were dirty, his eyes were dirty, his ass was dirty. He was double-jointed, asthmatic, lousy, picayune, morbid. I could have forgiven him everything if only he had handed me a decent breakfast. But a man who has 2,000 francs hidden away in a dirty sock and refuses to wear a clean shirt or smear a little butter over his bread, such a man is not just a fairy nor even just a miser. He's an imbecile. But that's neither here nor there about the fairy. I'm keeping an ear open as to what's going on downstairs. It's a Mr. Wren and his wife who have called to look at the apartment. They're talking about taking it. Only talking about it, thank God. Mrs. Wren has a loose laugh, complications ahead. Now Mr. Wren is talking. His voice is raucous, scraping, booming, a heavy blunt weapon that wedges its way through flesh and bone and cartilage. Boris calls me down to be introduced. He is rubbing his hands like a pawnbroker. They are talking about a story Mr. Wren wrote, a story about a spavined horse. But I thought Mr. Wren was a painter. To be sure, says Boris with a twinkle in his eye, but in the winter time he writes, and he writes well, remarkably well. I try to induce Mr. Wren to talk, to say something, anything, to talk about the spavined horse if necessary, but Mr. Wren is almost inarticulate. When he essays to speak of those dreary months with the pen, he becomes unintelligible. Months and months he spends before setting a word to paper, and there are only 3 months of winter. What does he cogitate, all those months and months of winter? So help me God, I can't see this guy as a writer. Yet Mrs. Wren says that when he sits down to it, the stuff just pours out. The talk drifts. It is difficult to follow Mr. Wren's mind because he says nothing. He thinks as he goes along, so Mrs. Wren puts it. Mrs. Wren puts everything about Mr. Wren in the loveliest light. He thinks as he goes along, very charming, charming indeed, as Borowski would say, but really very painful, particularly when the thinker is nothing but a spavined horse. Boris hands me money to buy liquor. Going for the liquor, I am already intoxicated. I know just how I'll begin when I get back to the house. Walking down the street, it commences, the grand speech inside me that's gurgling like Mrs. Wren's loose laugh. Seems to me she had a slight edge on already. Listens beautifully when she's tight. Coming out of the wine shop, I hear the urinal gurgling. Everything is loose and splashy. I want Mrs. Wren to listen. Boris is rubbing his hands again. Mr. Wren is still stuttering and spluttering. I have a bottle between my legs and I'm shoving the corkscrew in. Mrs. Wren has her mouth parted, expectantly. The wine is splashing between my legs, the sun is splashing through the bay window, and inside my veins there is a bubble and splash of 1,000 crazy things that commence to gush out of me now, pell-mell. I'm telling them everything that comes to mind, everything that was bottled up inside me, and which Mrs. Wren's loose laugh has somehow released. With that bottle between my legs and the sun splashing through the window, I experience once again the splendor of those miserable days when I first arrived in Paris. A bewildered, poverty-stricken individual who haunted the streets like a ghost at a banquet. Everything comes back to me in a rush, the toilets that wouldn't work, the prince who shined my shoes, the cinema splendide where I slept on the patron's overcoat, the bars in the window, the feeling of suffocation, the fat cockroaches, the drinking and carousing that went on between times, rosé canac and Naples dying in the sunlight. Dancing the streets on an empty belly, and now and then calling on strange people, Madame Delorme, for instance. How I ever got to Madame Delorme's, I can't imagine anymore. But I got there, got inside somehow, past the butler, past the maid with her little white apron, got right inside the palace with my corduroy trousers and my hunting jacket, and not a button on my fly. Even now I can taste again the golden ambience of that room where Madame Delorme sat upon a throne in her mannish rig, the goldfish in the bowls, the maps of the ancient world, the beautifully bound books. I can feel again her heavy hand resting upon my shoulder, frightening me a little with her heavy lesbian air. More comfortable down below, in that thick stew pouring into the Gare Saint-Lazare, the whores in the doorways, seltzer bottles on every table. A thick tide of semen flooding the gutters. nothing better between 5 and 7 than to be pushed around in that throng, to follow a leg or a beautiful bust, to move along with the tide and everything whirling in your brain. A weird sort of contentment in those days. No appointments, no invitations for dinner, no program, no dough. The golden period when I had not a single friend. Each morning the dreary walk to the American Express, and each morning the inevitable answer from the clerk. Dashing here and there like a bedbug, gathering butts now and then, sometimes furtively, sometimes brazenly. Sitting down on a bench and squeezing my guts to stop the gnawing, or walking through the Jardin des Tuileries and getting an erection looking at the dumb statues. Or wandering along the Seine at night, wandering and wandering, and going mad with the beauty of it, the trees leaning too, the broken images in the water, the rush of the current under the bloody lights of the bridges, the women sleeping in doorways, sleeping on newspapers, sleeping in the rain. Everywhere the musty porches of the cathedrals and beggars and lice and old hags full of St. Vitus's dance. Pushcarts stacked up like wine barrels in the side streets, the smell of berries in the marketplace, and the old church surrounded with vegetables and blue arc lights, the gutters slippery with garbage, and women in satin pumps staggering through the filth and vermin at the end of an all-night souse. The Place Saint-Sulpice, so quiet and deserted, where toward midnight there came every night the woman with the busted umbrella and the crazy veil. Every night she slept there on a bench under her torn umbrella, the ribs hanging down, her dress turning green, her bony fingers and the odor of decay oozing from her body. And in the morning I'd be sitting there myself, taking a quiet snooze in the sunshine, cursing the goddamned pigeons gathering up the crumbs everywhere. Saint-Sulpice! The fat belfries, the garish posters over the door, the candles flaming inside, the square so beloved of Anatole France, with that drone and buzz from the altar, the splash of the fountain, the pigeons cooing, the crumbs disappearing like magic, and only a dull rumbling in the hollow of the guts. Here I would sit, day after day, thinking of Germain, in that dirty little street near the Bastille where she lived, and that buzz-buzz going on behind the altar, the buses whizzing by, the sun beating down into the asphalt, and the asphalt working into me and Germain, into the asphalt and all Paris in the big, fat belfries. And it was down the Rue Bonaparte that only a year before Mona and I used to walk every night, after we had taken leave of Borowski, Saint-Sulpice not meaning much to me then, nor anything in Paris. Washed out with talk, sick of faces, fed up with cathedrals and squares and menageries and whatnot. Picking up a book in the red bedroom and the cane chair uncomfortable, tired of sitting on my ass all day long, tired of red wallpaper, tired of seeing so many people jabbering away about nothing. The red bedroom and the trunk always open, her gowns lying about in a delirium of disorder. The red bedroom with my galoshes and canes, the notebooks I never touched, the manuscripts lying cold and dead, Paris. Meaning the Café Select, the Dom, the Flea Market, the American Express, Paris, meaning Borowski's canes, Borowski's hats, Borowski's gouaches, Borowski's prehistoric fish, and prehistoric jokes. In that Paris of 28, only one night stands out in my memory, the night before sailing for America. A rare night, with Borowski slightly pickled and a little disgusted with me because I'm dancing with every slut in the place. But we're leaving in the morning. That's what I tell every cunt I grab hold of, leaving in the morning. That's what I'm telling the blonde with agate-colored eyes, and while I'm telling her, she takes my hand and squeezes it between her legs. In the lavatory, I stand before the bowl with a tremendous erection. It seems light and heavy at the same time, like a piece of lead with wings on it. And while I'm standing there like that, two cunts sail in, Americans. I greet them cordially, prick in hand. They give me a wink and pass on. In the vestibule, as I'm buttoning my fly, I notice one of them waiting for her friend to come out of the can. The music is still playing, and maybe Mona'll be coming to fetch me, or Borowski with his gold-knobbed cane, but I'm in her arms now, and she has hold of me, and I don't care who comes or what happens. We wriggle into the cabinet, and there I stand her up, slap up against the wall, and I try to get it into her, but it won't work, and so we sit down on the seat and try it that way, but it won't work either. No matter how we try it, it won't work. And all the while she's got hold of my prick, she's clutching it like a lifesaver, but it's no use. We're too hot, too eager. The music is still playing, and so we waltz out of the cabinet into the vestibule again, and as we're dancing there in the shithouse, I come all over her beautiful gown, and she's sore as hell about it. I stumble back to the table, and there's Borowski with his ruddy face, and Mona with her disapproving eye, and Borowski says, "Let's all go to Brussels tomorrow." And we agree, and when we get back to the hotel, I vomit all over the place, in the bed, in the washbowl, over the suits and gowns and the galoshes and canes, and the notebooks I never touched, and the manuscripts cold and dead. A few months later, the same hotel, the same room. We look out on the courtyard where the bicycles are parked, and there is the little room up above under the attic where some smart young Alec played the phonograph all day long and repeated clever little things at the top of his voice. I say we, but I'm getting ahead of myself, because Mona has been away a long time, and it's just today that I'm meeting her at the Gare Saint-Lazare. Toward evening I'm standing there with my face squeezed between the bars, but there's no Mona, and I read the cable over again, but it doesn't help any. I go back to the quarter, and just the same, I put away a hearty meal. Strolling past the Dom a little later, suddenly I see a pale, heavy face and burning eyes and the little velvet suit that I always adore, because under the soft velvet there were always her warm breasts, the marble legs, cool, firm, muscular. She rises up out of a sea of faces and embraces me passionately. 1,000 eyes, noses, fingers, legs, bottles, windows, purses, saucers, all glaring at us, and we in each other's arms, oblivious. I sit down beside her, and she talks. A flood of talk. Wild, consumptive notes of hysteria, perversion, leprosy. I hear not a word because she is beautiful, and I love her, and now I am happy and willing to die. We walk down the Rue du Château, looking for Eugene. Walk over the railroad bridge where I used to watch the trains pulling out and feel all sick inside, wondering where the hell she could be. Everything soft and enchanting as we walk over the bridge, smoke coming up between our legs, the tracks creaking, semaphores in our blood. I feel her body close to mine, all mine now, and I stop to rub my hands over the warm velvet. Everything around us is crumbling, and the warm body under the warm velvet is aching for me. Back in the very same room, and 50 francs to the good, thanks to Eugene. I look out on the court, but the phonograph is silent. The trunk is open, and her things are lying around everywhere, just as before. She lies down on the bed with her clothes on. Once, twice, 3 times, 4 times. I'm afraid she'll go mad. In bed, under the blankets, how good to feel her body again. But for how long? Will it last this time? Already I have a presentiment that it won't. She talks to me so feverishly, as if there will be no tomorrow. Be quiet, Mona. Just look at me. Don't talk. Finally she drops off, and I pull my arm from under her. My eyes close. Her body is there beside me. It will be there till morning, surely. It was in February I pulled out of the harbor in a blinding snowstorm. The last glimpse I had of her was in the window waving goodbye to me. A man standing on the other side of the street at the corner, his hat pulled down over his eyes, his jowls resting on his lapels, a fetus watching me, a fetus with a cigar in its mouth. Mona at the window waving goodbye, white heavy face, hair streaming wild, and now it is a heavy bedroom, breathing regularly through the gills, sap still oozing from between her legs, a warm feline odor, and her hair in my mouth. My eyes are closed. We breathe warmly into each other's mouth. Close together, America 3,000 miles away. I never want to see it again. To have her here in bed with me, breathing on me, her hair in my mouth, I count that something of a miracle. Nothing can happen now, till morning. I wake from a deep slumber to look at her. A pale light is trickling in. I look at her beautiful wild hair. I feel something crawling down my neck. I look at her again, closely. Her hair is alive. I pull back the sheet. More of them. They are swarming over the pillow. It is a little after daybreak. We pack hurriedly and sneak out of the hotel. The cafes are still closed. We walk, and as we walk, we scratch ourselves. The day opens in milky whiteness, streaks of salmon pink sky, snails leaving their shells. Paris. Paris. Everything happens here. Old crumbling walls and the pleasant sound of water running in the urinals, men licking their mustaches at the bar, shutters going up with a bang and little streams purling in the gutters, Amer Piquant in huge scarlet letters, zigzag. Which way will we go, and why?